It's Wednesday, January 17, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the official start to the 2024 election season, the Iowa caucuses. We'll talk about the coverage from Monday night. Hearings this week in Jefferson City as lawmakers examine changes yet again to the Missouri Sunshine Law. And it was the most ever streamed event in U.S. history, the Chiefs wild card win against the Dolphins. We'll talk about the winners and losers from Saturday night's game. And a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with the sale of the Baltimore Sun. Why, you ask, are we choosing to lead a program about media in mid-Missouri with a discussion about the sale of a newspaper on the Eastern Seaboard? Well, this one has some nuance. It's kind of noteworthy. This is the first time in nearly four decades that that paper will be locally owned. And that's something we've talked about on this program as being really important to get newspapers out of the hands of hedge funds like Alden Global Capital, which has been known to gut papers across the country. And the buyer is a guy by the name of David D. Smith. Here's where it gets interesting. Smith is the chairman of Sinclair Incorporated. Yes, that's Sinclair, the television ownership group that we've talked about oh so many times for its ties to the Trump administration, its must-run commentaries, and so on. So where do you, Ernest, fall on this one? Is this purchase good for the Baltimore Sun and for some of the other regional papers in that area, or not so much?
Well, I mean, when you look at the reasons that have been given by Smith and others for the purchase, it does seem like a good thing. He's from Baltimore. Sinclair and the Sinclair station started with the station that was purchased by him about four decades ago in Baltimore. So. He says that he wanted to basically purchase the Sun and these other papers in order to bring in more local control and have more local news in the newspaper. And it's sort of a way for him to basically say, hey, I'm giving back to the community that I know, the community that I've grown up in, and this is the way I want to do it.
So unlike some other attempts to bring local ownership to the Baltimore Sun as recently as 2-3 years ago, this offer was accepted in large part because it was fully funded. He was paying for it himself. Apart from his role in Sinclair, where or how do we kind of see that separation shaping up here?
Well, you know, as you pointed out, he purchased this from Alden Capital, which is it's been nicknamed pretty aptly, I think, a vulture capitalist corporation, because they have really stripped and hollowed out the newsrooms that they have purchased. So as Ernest said, this could be a hopeful sign. The question, though, is what will happen now that this owner, who, as you also pointed out, has had a tendency to mix his own political points of view with that of his news operations, will he keep hands off on the editorial staff? The Baltimore Sun has a storied history of doing great reporting and recently won a Pulitzer Prize for local reporting that drove a corrupt mayor out of office. The problem is that the new owner didn't seem to recognize that fact. In his first meeting with the staff, he said they haven't been covering local news enough and made it really clear he has not been reading the paper. So I think the question is, how is he going to proceed? He really demoralized the staff in that first meeting. These are papers just like the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Kansas City Star in our own state, which have been working on very limited, very reduced resources and still doing great work. And that was the wrong message to send. And then I think the second question is, what will he do? He is an independent owner. He's buying this as an individual, not as the CEO of Sinclair. Mm-hmm. And now, how will he go forward as an owner? Is it, if he operates the way Sinclair has operated, it could be problematic, because you don't want to politics to be mixed up in the newspaper's editorial agenda.
And, you know, and the other thing is, exactly, you don't want the politics mixed up in it. But then if you look at Sinclair, they operate on the margins as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the fact that Alden came in, they pretty much gutted the Baltimore Sun the way they've done every other operation that they purchased. The question becomes, will he invest in the Baltimore Sun to allow them to be able to do more local news?
And to take it even to its pre-2000 days before Tribune purchased it and gutted it before Alden even had a chance. In fact, if you're a fan of the show The Wire, the final season of that show was almost entirely about the police department's relationship with the news media and portrayed how that paper itself had been destroyed in large part by a remote and distant owner. So there's also news out west in another former Tribune Company newspaper that was bought up by a local billionaire. Kevin Meredith stepped down from his position as executive editor at the Los Angeles Times on Friday, applauded by hundreds of staffers as he departed the building. Now, the official company line here is that the split was a mutual decision that was agreed to by both Kevin Meredith and the paper's owner. But insiders say that this wasn't much of a surprise, that there hadn't been a strong relationship between the two, and that since November, it had broken down even further to a point where it was almost a stalemate.
Yeah, and I've known Kevin Meredith for over 40 years,
yeah. Right?
And we go way all the way back to my days in journalism in Texas, and it's almost like you could sort of see this coming. When you had this new owner who came in and wanted to have influence within the newsroom and what the newsroom was doing, and that's just not the way that Kevin operates. He truly believes in the separation of the business side from the news side, and that ownership shouldn't have the kind of influence that the new owner wanted to have. And so they kind of butted heads from the beginning, and I think it is just sort of escalated from that point. And Kevin said, hey, you know, I'm not going to do this. But he's had a history of this. I mean, he had the same issue when he was working at the Undefeated with ESPN, and then ESPN came in and some executives there said, hey, we want to do this, we want to do that. And Kevin's like, whoa, wait a minute, that's not the agreement that we had when we started this. And thus he moved out of the Undefeated. So this is not new when you talk about Kevin Meredith and the way in which he operates as a journalist and as a journalism executive.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Full disclosure, I too go back way back with Kevin Meredith because we were members of the Texas Press Corps together in Washington, and I think it's a remarkable testament to his being a reporter's editor, that which is what you've just described, Ernest, that he did get a standing ovation as he left. He handled this in a really classy way, I think. But I think the larger story here, we have talked and applauded the elevation of Kevin and other people who aren't white males to various positions of power in newsrooms. But let's face it, this opportunity is coming for all of these people because things in the news business aren't so good. And Kevin had to preside over a round of layoffs that he said it himself, had to be excruciatingly painful. And the fact that he's out there fighting is great, but I think we really have to ask ourselves, you know, what are people inheriting here? And it's a big mess. And I think he did the best he could, but did the right thing, wasn't going to knuckle under to cuts that he thought were going to be damaging to the newsroom.
In addition to cuts, there's a story on our Links blog and a series of stories that are coming out as you talk about the reporter's editor, that some of the disagreements that were coming, and this is all coming from anonymous sources within the newsroom, were also the result of meddling on the part of the ownership, that Kevin had made a decision to force recusal on the 20 or so staffers who had signed an open letter joining close to 1,500 journalists that was condemning Israel and requesting certain language be used in coverage, that the owner had been meddling on some stories as it related to science and health reporting, citing his background in science and medicine, and that it was also as much about not letting the journalists do the journalism.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, like I said, you know, that's something that that Kevin was felt really strongly about. I mean, he is a journalist. He's like, hey, look, you know, we need to have some sort of dividing line between, you know, what the owner believes should happen and what journalists should be doing. In other words, we need to be able to say, hey, we are presenting the facts as they're happening, without any kind of partisanship or opinion or that sort of thing, and we leave the opinion page to the opinion page.
Well, and one of the quotes that was in the stories you can find on our links blog was saying that, like, you know, we can start by applauding the big billionaires who are coming in to save local news. We're talking about what could be happening in Baltimore. We talk about this here with the Los Angeles Times. We've talked about it with Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post. And what that insider was saying is that when you have a Jeff Bezos who buys the Washington Post, he's made it really clear his attitude is to learn and let the journalists do the journalism, and that the people in the newsroom weren't experiencing or seeing or witnessing that same interest in learning as opposed to having a position they wanted covered.
Yeah, it's like you don't want the owner of the team to also try to be the coach.
Right.
Right? It's the same thing here. Let the professionals do their job. Publishers have a role to play.
Well, and the LA Times does not have a publisher.
Right. Well,
that's another one of the challenges here as
it's
well.
It's like the owner trying to be the general manager.
Right. No, yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I think it does go back to one of the points that you were making about this is a mess. I mean, what's happening with traditional journalism right now? I mean, we've talked about the disruption. I think it's gone way past disruption at this point. To what kind of environment, what kind of ecosystem, both on the business side as well as on the news producing side, are we going to have? And right now, you have these owners who are coming in, be they Alden or be they individuals like Smith, come in and buy. At some point, they're going to go like, wait a minute, you know, I can't continue to put money into this and dump money into this and not see some return on investments. And when that happens, or that doesn't happen, you start to see the layoffs. You start to see the pulling back. I mean, we've seen Jeff Bezos did the same thing with the Washington Post. It was happening with the LA Times. You could almost see it happening in Baltimore, mm-hmm. even though you have someone who just basically purchased this for over $600 million. And so what's happening there, and I think we're still going through that disruptive part of people are getting their news from very different places, and we haven't, as a traditional journalism entities, been able to connect with those in a way that can also generate enough revenue to operate our
newspapers. Well, I think you can connect. You just have to not expect 20% profit margin. I mean, that's the real problem.
And that's been over for a long time.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And if you're going in with that expectation, you might as well not go in. But if you're going in because you want to be a part of your community and you want to contribute to your community and you want to be a community leader, go for it. But let the professionals, let the journalists be journalists, and you be the owner.
Okay. Let's take a look at something going on a little bit closer to home, where members of the Missouri House of Representatives held a hearing in Jefferson City yesterday to discuss House Bill 1720. Now, Kathy, there's an effort just about every legislative session to attempt to weaken the state Sunshine Law, and this attempt itself has weakened quite recently. What are they trying to do this time?
Well, there's been some great reporting on this by some of our alums, too.
Shout out to Joe McLean, who is the Gray Company's bureau chief reporting statewide.
Yes, he did a great story. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch also had a story. The sponsor of this bill, which was a quite lengthy piece of legislation that would have had numerous exemptions from the Sunshine Law, has ratcheted it back considerably. The only exemption that is now left, the biggest eyebrow raiser in the original bill, would have exempted all of the state legislature's communications from Sunshine, and that is something that the residents of Missouri voted against. They voted to make those sunshineable, those communications, in 2018, I believe. So the legislature was trying to undo that and has consistently tried to undo it. This, Representative Faulkner, who was the sponsor of this, pulled that back. But there is a remaining exemption that would exempt names of minor children who participate in publicly
hearing
sponsored events. You know, Gene Manicky, who is the attorney for the Missouri Press Association, raised an objection to that, and I agree. On the surface, it sounds benign, but really, this is just another attempt to pull public disclosure away from the public. And, you know, I get where the lawmakers are coming from here. It's one thing when you're dealing with news professionals, a relatively limited universe of people you can talk to and say, hey, be reasonable. Now that everybody's a publisher, it's a little bit different. But I do think the more exemptions we put into the law, the more broadly those can be interpreted, and the less the public really gets to see about what's going on in the government. A public program that minors participate in, we want to know, is that an effective program?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Who's getting to participate in it? Are the minors rich kids? Are they people who need public assistance? These are all questions we might want to have answers to. So I think, you know, the bottom line is, if we know somebody's watching, we tend to behave better. And the Sunshine Law, it was originally passed 50 years ago, was a page and a half. Now it's like 30-plus pages, and most of those 30-plus pages are exemptions. So I think the public should be wary when they see any exemption being offered.
No, I'm in total agreement with that. I mean, just this, if they, you know, if they get this exemption, they're going to ask for another exemption. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you made a perfect analogy. Starts off as a page and a half, and now it's 30 pages because, well, we need to exempt this, we need to exempt that. And every time you add an exemption, you lose transparency. And that's to me, where I think the taxpayers and the voters basically said in 2018, hey, that's not what we want. We want to have that transparency and be able to see what our government officials, be they bureaucrats or elected officials, are doing.
Well, and so, you know, I can't shake that feeling that many of the provisions that were in the original bill have been pulled back, in part because perhaps Faulkner is hoping if he can get the one past the goalie next year, he can bring back one more, and the year after that, one more, and eventually get all of those provisions that certain members of the legislature are looking for that all at once may be really alarming.
Yeah, and I wouldn't put this just on Representative Faulkner. The legislators, I mean, this...
And the governor.
Yes, a major attempt. And we don't see a lot of support, even from the Attorney General's office, which is supposed to enforce this law. This is a law that reporters use it a lot, but it is really the public that uses it even more. Mm-hmm. So it's a public issue.
And it is the thing that really bothers me about this is that it's not just the Republicans. When they're in power, they do it. When the Democrats in power, they want exemptions. It's like everyone wants to sort of hide behind some sort of exemption, some sort of shield, so that the taxpayers and the voters can't see what's going on.
Yes, if you're in power. And I will remind our listeners that the Sunshine Law was signed into law by a Republican governor and first enforced by a Republican attorney general, Kit Bond and Jack Danforth. So it's really a question of who's in power and who has something they want to hide.
Right.
Okay. Well, that chill in the air means only one thing. Voters in Iowa and New Hampshire are getting the ball rolling on the 2024 election season. Monday night, Republicans braved the conditions to caucus, overwhelmingly supporting Donald Trump. Nothing here was unexpected, except maybe how quickly the networks called it for Trump.
Yeah, they called it that morning almost.
Yeah, I mean, they were using the entrance polling, and a lot of people were really upset about the networks calling it so early because the surrogates were still speaking in many of the caucus locations. There hadn't been an actual vote cast yet.
Yeah, super tacky. You know, when will we learn? And it's just, why? Because you want to be the first organization to call, to state the obvious, that Donald Trump is winning. I mean, there were the Iowa poll, which is terrific, by Ann Selzer, predicted this. And so why did you have to rush to judgment while people are still deliberating?
Because I had nothing else to talk
exactly.
about.
And that is the problem. You know, we really should be talking about the issues that the Iowa voters are confronting, but that requires time, money, and reporting. And instead of just having panels on, just trying to fill air endlessly and who's going to win and who's not going to win, what are the candidates? What's the substance of what the candidates are offering? And what is the substance of what the voters are dealing with? And we still are not doing that.
Yeah, but I mean, if you pull it all back, mm-hmm. we're basically looking at a rematch of the general election that we just had 4 years ago, okay?
And we've
been litigating ever since.
Never ends.
And it's almost like we're trying to, you know, the national media, especially the cable outlets, are sort of trying to prepare the country for the final showdown between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. You know, this is it. This is a, you know, mano y mano. And it's, I think by the time we get there, the public is going to be like, enough, you know, just,
I think
sort
the
of
public's
tired.
Kind of sort of there already,
yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Because they are hearing and seeing everything as they had in a very polarized environment. Some of that same entrance polling that was used to so quickly determine or lead the networks to call it, people were saying in very high numbers that the that Trump had won the election, that it was a lot of the election deniers and very high rates of people who were saying that even if he's convicted, that he's still fit for office. And then you're going to also find those in that mano-a-mano showdown again, who are equally as far encamped on the left.
But, you know, and here's the thing.
Yeah.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump are not inherently interesting anymore. I mean, we know who these people are.
Right.
So why don't we, I mean, I am less interested in Donald Trump and Joe Biden than the people who are voting for Donald Trump. Why would you want to vote for someone who, I don't know, I wouldn't want him babysitting my kid. And why would you want to vote for someone who has all this legal baggage and who is kind of, you know, it is so problematic in so many ways. The story to me is not what has Donald Trump said or tweeted or whatever today. The story is, why are there people who want to vote for him? What's their story, right? And I think that would be far more revealing than any of this, you know, studio wrestling.
But, you know, I think you can take it further. Why don't we do stories on what are people really concerned about?
Amen.
I mean, you know, if you look at all the economic indicators, this country has fared pretty well coming out of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. You'd never know
you'd
it.
Never
if
know
you...
that. Those are the stories that I
exactly.
think we need that the news media needs to be out there talking about. It's like not who's going to vote for whom, or but looking at it in terms of, what are my concerns? Am I doing okay economically? I know what the economic indicators say, but here's the issues that I'm concerned about. Those stories are, I think that they're being done, but they are so removed
they're
from
not
the everyday.
Being shown on prime time
right.
every
right.
night. They are not. And that, I think, you know, you've just nailed it. I think that would be actually helpful to the candidates
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. if they were concerned about that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Saturday night, the Kansas City Chiefs fans played a part in NFL and internet history, counting themselves among the 23 million viewers to watch the AFC wildcard game streaming on Peacock, signaling the first time an NFL playoff game was only available on a premium subscription streaming site. NBC said in a release that the game was the most ever watched live stream event and was responsible for 30% of all internet use in the U.S. Saturday night, the single most ever amount of bandwidth sucked up on a single date. It's a touchdown for the NFL and Peacock, but not so much for fans.
No, and I understand that they're glowing and they say, hey, this is a success. Well, you have to attribute it to, number one, there was nothing else to watch. Number two, it was cold everywhere in the entire country. And people are like, hey, I'm stuck at home. I'm going to go ahead and sign up for this. The question becomes, what happens at the end of the month when the $5.99 comes due?
I can tell you right now what happens at the end of the month when the $5.99 comes due. Most people are going to forget about it and get charged $5.99 again.
Well, you're probably right. But the question is, will they get charged $5.99 the second month?
That's what Peacock is hoping, obviously. Yeah. And I think fans just really see through this. And interestingly, you're already seeing pushback from the political front.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Here's an issue where the members really understand the voters.
Well, and this is the first time in 50 years that, okay, the second time ever in the first in 50 years that a playoff game wasn't available somewhere on free TV.
Right. Exactly. And that has caused, there was one lawmaker, Pat Ryan, who I think is a Democrat from New York, who is raising the issue. Hey, NFL, what about that antitrust exemption we give you, know, with the taxpayer money? What service are our taxpayers getting? And I think you're going to hear that more and more.
Because I think you're right.
I'm going to tell you, as a Pittsburgh fan, I was praying we did not draw that slot, because people are infuriated if you can't see your team on the air somewhere.
Well, I mean, the draw was the Chiefs, and that sort of pulled everybody in, and then you had the Dolphins, which pulled in Florida and probably some people from New York, and it's just one of those things where you kind of go, wait a minute, has the NFL and NBC overstepped? And the question becomes, is that pushback going to be sustainable to maybe force the NFL to say, hey, we need to look at this and determine whether or not we want to do this.
I also look at
again.
The regular season games, though, on Amazon, and I almost have to wonder if we've crossed the Rubicon.
Well, a lot of those, there are some good regular season games with on Amazon Prime, but a lot of those games are not the marquee games. Those marquee games are still on network television or on the cable where everyone has access to look at it.
Okay, very quickly before we go, because we don't have a lot of time yet, but we have to talk about that amazing photo from the Kansas City Star photographer.
Great work by the photographer.
Right, being there at that instant when Mahomes' helmet cracked and broke. Classic case of being in the right place at the right time, anticipating action that you don't know you need to anticipate.
Absolutely. And kudos to the photo editor from the Kansas City Star who posted that on social media and pointed out, I get to edit in the warmth of my office. These reporters are out in the cold trying to make their fingers move at the right moment.
Mm. Right, absolutely.
Amazing journalism.
And telling that story. Well, that music means we're out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about everything we talked about on our Links blog under the Programs and Podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, and see what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager. I'm Amy Simons. Join us again next week for another edition of Views of the News.